children. We're starting.
That's right.
Showtime. Another Fresh Picked Pod from audio2u.com. Shutters Inc. With Shelton Muller.
You might wish to stay on and listen.
Hi, and welcome to episode 67 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from audio2.com, and with me on the line once again from Melbourne via Skype, Shelton Muller. How are you?
G'day. No, I'm good, Bruce. How you doing, mate?
Excellent.
Good to hear.
What's
nice
new?
To hear your. Nice to hear a happy chirp in your voice there, mate. You know, I thought Sydney was a depressing town, but no, you guys are happy.
Oh, it has its moments.
No,
I was just saying to someone yesterday that, you know, I love Sydney, but I absolutely detest the traffic.
Yeah, and I reckon there'd be people who'd come from other cities, I visited, who'd say, boy, you guys get it easy driving around here. There'd probably be a few New Yorkers who'd say that, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and LA people.
And LA, and there'd probably be some of our listeners in, you know, I don't know if we have too many Japanese listeners, but I don't think the traffic in places like Tokyo would be, you know, so, but I know compared to Melbourne driving, I wouldn't drive through Sydney if you paid me. I get the taxi drivers for that.
No.
You know, I'd rather get some crazy taxi driver to get me to my destination.
I've driven in all of the state capitals except for Darwin, and Darwin's only a big country town, really.
Yeah,
there's only about 80,000 people in Darwin.
Yeah.
And Sydney is by far the worst place to drive.
Yeah, that's because of the nature of its, well, lack of design. I mean, Sydney was just built, you know, they just put a building here and a building there, and it slowly spread outwards, and then suddenly they said, hey, we need a plan.
Yeah.
So the roads, if ever you visit Sydney, folks, it's a beautiful city. It has just a gorgeous harbour, and it's, you know, just a lovely, lovely city, but the roads just go everywhere. And for traffic, you know, you'll suddenly find yourself, you know, entering a one-way street that wasn't a one-way street a minute ago, because it's curved around this building that was just plonked there in 1807, and you know, it's just, you know, it's a crazy place. It's in the, especially, you know, around the harbour area and inner city. It's just a crazy place.
And what makes it worse, you know, from a lack of planning point of view, is that they will build a road as a two-lane road, and then later on go, gee, that's really not coping with the amount of traffic. We really need three lanes. So they'll just turn the two lanes into a three-lane road. So you've got these lanes that you've got like a nanometer of space either side of the line. And it is just ridiculous.
Yeah, God forbid you should get some Thunderbird, you know, from the 50s or 60s, a big wide car.
Well, mate, I can tell you, it's pretty hair-raising, you know, going past a truck on some of Sydney's roads, because you know, the truck takes up the full width of the lane right out to the white line.
Yep.
And, you know, you're trying to squeeze past, and it's like, ooh. Yeah, and so, sorry to get off topic, people, but, you know, here in Sydney, they built a road called the M2. Which is sort of part of the ring road project that they're trying to build to circumnavigate the whole of Sydney. So if you're coming from north and you want to go south of Sydney, you can jump on the ring road and go all the way around. This M2, right, was opened, I don't know, I'm guessing around about 98 or 99, right? So it's been open for about 7 or 8 years, right? But I was talking to somebody who lives here where I, you know, in the suburb where I live. This old lady who, you know, she was probably in her 60s or 70s when I spoke to her a couple of years ago, and she was saying that the planning for the M2 actually began in the 60s, right? And so it took them 30 years to get the road built. Now, when they opened it, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, it was two lanes, and now already they're going, yeah, we're going to get rid of that breakdown lane and we're going to turn it into a third lane. And it's like, geez, guys, it took you 30 years to get approval through to build the road. Couldn't you have just sort of, you know, thought, well, you know, it's taken this long. Maybe we should throw an extra lane into the planning?
Yes.
Anyway.
The 60s, yeah. Well, maybe because, you know, they weren't really there. So, you know. So that's what happened.
Maybe.
Oh, boy.
Let's get on to things photographic.
Yeah, that's a good idea. A couple of things. If listeners go to, and this is just a point of interest, I mean, you know, if they're interested in seeing more about what we've been talking about getting it right in camera and using filters and things like we always have, the good people at Kokin, and I have mentioned this before, but they've actually updated it, have got me on their website. If you go to Kokin.com, C-O-K-I-N, Kokin.com, and go to the experiences section, it's on the top menu, you'll see my ugly mug and a few photographs that they have used of mine in a gallery that's sort of devoted to me, little old me, and my photography. I'm sort of their Aussie guy, I'm their Aussie guy. And if you just want to see some of the images that I've taken using Kokin filters, it'll give you an idea of what I mean, you know, when I talk about, you know, getting the image right in camera, which I absolutely, you know, believe in as much as possible. And, you know, that will sort of just give you an idea, as long as, you know, you want to go there, have a look at good old Kokin filters. Walt from Newfoundland, thank you very, very much. Yeah.
Before you carry on, I just wanted to mention that I did put a link to that page on the Kokin website, either in the show notes for last week or the week before.
Right.
So have a look on the Shutters Inc. page at the show notes for either ep 66 or 65, and you should find a link to that Kokin page that'll just take you straight through.
Oh, you see, I've got to visit the site more often. Thanks, mate. Appreciate that. What a hypocrite I am. Well, you know, I do. I sort of know what's in the podcast, so I don't have to you know, download the thing.
Right.
But yeah, thank you for uploading that. And look, sorry, everybody. I look completely inundated here at work, and I forgot to get the images uploaded that you know, I finally did. The difference between HDR and using, you know, a filter and getting it right in camera. But that image, which is of a Canadian landscape, is, I presume, now up and running.
Yep.
So if you want to check out the difference, go back to the website and have a look, to revisit the podcast from last week wherein I briefly mentioned the difference between, say, what I had encountered with HDR and what we had achieved with using a grad filter, and my preferences, you know, for the reasons that I mentioned in the podcast. You can actually see the difference in the two photographs.
I think even blind Freddie would see the difference in the two photographs, to be honest.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that HDR doesn't work. All it is, you know, all it is to say is that it's not necessarily the be-all and end-all of, you know, shadow and highlight detail, and that it is an extra process that you can avoid if you do your best to get the image right in camera.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to get people back to the culture that we used to have, which was a culture that worked of using the camera as an imaging tool and not software to sort of, you know, to make that which was completely possible in camera, you know, the final process. So go back to audio2u.com and check the Shutters Inc., you know, last episode, and you can see the difference between my experience, brief, albeit, valid, between the HDR and using a filter, a G2. But like I say, I balance that out again by saying HDR is fine. It's just not going to work for you every time. Mm. So get as much right in camera as possible, and you won't have to go to HDR. And if you do, it'll be a lot better. So that's all I'm really saying.
Beautiful.
Jamie, now...
You were going to start with Walt.
Oh, yes, Walt. Yes, sorry, mate. Now it's not a Newfoundland thing, okay? I just completely forgot you there for a moment. Walt has emailed us from Newfoundland in Canada. And what a great idea he's got. He has suggested that we do a competition, which will involve, you know, you guys sending us some photographs and, you know, us critiquing them and coming up with a winner, la, la, la. Now, Bruce and I are going to use our collective genius between now and next week to come up with which should come up together we've probably got an IQ of about 43 or something. You know, you're the 39 and I'm the final four, and we'll come up with something that will get all our listeners involved. So
you know, there's three kinds of people in the world, don't you, Shelton? Those that understand maths and those that don't.
I like it. Oh, I like that. Can I use that?
Go for it.
I never heard that before. That's excellent. And so we're going to come back next week with some details for a competition that will involve all of you guys, so and girls who are listening. So thank you, Walt. That's a really great idea. We really
absolutely
appreciate that. Jamie has sent us an email asking two things. One, he's asked me about archival quality wedding albums for wedding photographers. Jamie, get back to me, mate, because I don't I can't remember where you live. If you're an Australian, I can give you some ideas, but in overseas, I'd have to find out, but I can give you some ideas, and we can do that, you know, once you confirm where you are, mate, next week on the podcast. But it is an interesting question. He also asked, and it's very interesting that you asked this, Jamie, about the Sigma 30mm 1.4 lens. Now, last week I was going on and on and on about the Fuji S5 launch and what a lovely time I had on Sydney Harbour, and I won't do that again because that was just very cruel of me to go on and on and on about what a fabulous time I had on a catamaran with all these cameras and photographers and models. I won't go on and on and on again about the great time that I had on this catamaran on a beautiful sunny day on Sydney Harbour with all these photographers and models. But one of the photographers there that I mentioned, David Williams, who is just a lovely guy and a great photographer, pulls up with an S5, and what's he got on the front, mate? But he's got a 30mm Sigma f1.4. Now, I had not actually seen the lens in the flesh, but had heard about it and had thought, well, what a great idea, because in my day, many, many years ago, when I first started selling cameras, and right up until, you know, well, only 10 years or so ago, cameras always came packaged with a 50mm 1.8 lens or 1.7 lens, depending on what you bought. That was basically the kit. In those days, you didn't sort of buy a camera with a 28-80 or a 35-70 or nowadays you'd get an 18-50 or an 18-70 or something like that. You'd buy it with a 50mm 1.8. It was a great thing to do because if you didn't have the money to buy a lens, you were stuck with the camera and a standard, what we called a standard lens. Now, this lens has a focal length, the 50mm lens, as we most of us would probably know, had the focal length that sort of matched the human eye. The human eye has much wider vision, but it had the same level of magnification, approximately, as the human eye. It didn't bring things closer, it didn't push things farther away. It was about what you saw.
It didn't compress the distance.
It was why we called it the standard lens. And what it did was teach you to take the best photographs possible with those limitations. And that's a great lesson. In fact, a fellow who studied photography at that time, who's a friend of mine, he was in a photographic college, and he said that for the first, it was a 4-year course or something like that, and for the first year, they were only allowed to shoot with a 50mm lens. Everything. Wow. And he said, boy, did that teach you. It taught you, such an incredible gift. It gave you the gift and talent of being able to get by with that one lens and see with it. So that the moment your opportunities opened for other lenses, you knew why and how to use them. It was a great lesson. But the 30mm 1.4 is Sigma's answer to that lens. And basically, because so many photographers loved using a 50mm, they've created this 30mm, which is sort of gives you, you know, the approximate, the same sort of magnification. And at f1.4, it's a great lens for available light. So I have, Jamie, to answer your question, I'm being very long-winded about this, but I have no personal experience with this lens, but I spoke to David about it, and he loves it. He absolutely loves it. I've never been a fan of Sigma lenses. Well, I for a while haven't been a fan of Sigma lenses. Not that it has anything to do with it optically. I believe optically they're excellent, and naturally from lens to lens, that will vary in any lens manufacturer. But I haven't of recent been a fan of their construction. But this particular lens felt like a proper lens, felt like proper light, built good in that.
Done good, eh, Gov?
Like one you could use in that. And it was a good lens. David loves it, and he has done a lot of professional work with it. And images that I saw from, you know, that day on the catamaran, that I won't go on and on about how fantastic it was, images that I saw him take in studio with that lens, Jamie, were fabulous. Sharp, and, you know, he shot at 2.8, and it was just beautiful. So that's about the best answer I can give you. If you think you want one, go out and get one. I'm probably going to have a look at one myself, because it's a really great idea.
Now, a question about that.
Mm.
Most digital camera sensors are either 3/4 frame or full frame.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it was a 3/4 frame, then the 30mm would actually be equivalent to about 40mm. And if it's full frame, then it's equivalent to a 30mm.
Yes, yes. Well, if you have a 1.5 magnification, it takes it to about a 45 mil in 35 millimeter terms.
Okay,
1.6, you're closer to the 50 mil, you know. And so that's basically what they've tried to do.
But that multiplier only is relevant if you've got a three-quarter frame sensor, right?
An APS-C size sensor, yeah. If you've got...
So if you've got a full-frame sensor, you are really getting 30 mil.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
Yes, it would be the equivalent of what, well, the same in 35 mil terms, a 30 millimeter lens or a wide angle lens.
A great lens, though. Don't get me wrong.
Oh yeah. But there's only a handful of cameras with what we call the full. I mean, they're all full frame sensors, so it's a misnomer to say a full frame sensor because they're all full frame sensors.
Yeah,
they're just different sizes. Now I'm just being pedantic on you, Bruce. I'm just annoyed that they've used that term, but not that I've anything against Canon. Love Canon. Good gear.
So what should the correct terminology be?
I don't know.
An APS-C size?
The APS-C size sensor is the one used in most digital SLRs.
Right.
And then there's the large, 35 millimeter style frame, but I don't know what I'd call it, but it's a full frame maybe is the easiest way for them to say it, but they all use the full frame.
Yeah.
It's just this one is, it's the same size as what photographers are used to with a 35 mil camera, so their lenses would still magnify the same. Is basically what they're trying to achieve.
So, quick question without notice: what is the diagonal measurement of a C size sensor?
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Okay.
Yep. I had one of those and the leg fell off. Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that.
Oh, man. Are you going to delete this from the podcast? Are you just like in the editing? Are you going to let everybody hear that I didn't know that? Oh, I know that 35 mil was 36 by 24 millimeters. You work out the math on the diagonal. I'm here to talk about taking pictures, man. I'm not some mathematical geek.
But is 35 mil based on the horizontal width of the frame or on the diagonal of the frame?
It was 35 mil was called because the frame was 36 by 24. 36 long and 24 across or high. So,
I always thought it was measured diagonally.
Mm.
Well, there you go. You learn something every day.
There you go. Yeah. It was 36 by 24 mil.
Ah.
And it was actually came from film, like film, motion picture film. And I think it was Leica who actually said, "Hey, let's put that in our cameras and just change the way that it sits." And so that's basically how it came about. The whole sprocketing and everything came from motion picture,
right?
And was put into rangefinder cameras in the early 1900s. So there you go.
Wow.
How it all came about. That 30 mil lens is quite lovely. I haven't actually seen whether other lens manufacturers, generic lens manufacturers, are making a lens of that equivalent, but it's certainly an interesting idea. And he raves about it. So there you go, Jamie. But the big thing I want to talk about today, sorry to take so long to get here, folks, but my loquacious manner combined with my love of the subject and your emails make these podcasts longer and longer. Sean, thank you for your email, and you talk about a situation I think that is familiar to all of us, at least in principle. Sean attends with his family ballet. His wife is involved in a ballet company, if I remember correctly the email, and you can correct me on this if I'm wrong, Sean. And the only reason, let me tell you, the only reason that I haven't got my email open right now is because, one, I'm on Skype, and...
an email comes in, it goes bing!
Well, an email comes in, and I get and I've set up my computer so that what was her name from the Addams Family? Carolyn Jones played her, Morticia.
Right.
Morticia. I have whenever the mail comes in, I get this Claxton, roar, and she goes, "Mail's in," and it's as loud as anything in my headphones. And I've been on Skype before, and I've been on podcasts, and suddenly I've got this email come in the middle of a podcast, and I get this Claxton, roar, "Mail's in my headphones," and I'm trying to talk about photography. And so I've turned my email off for the moment so that while I'm doing this podcast, I'm not getting any emails. So, Sean, forgive me, but if I have your email open, and suddenly somebody sends me an email, I could be thrown completely by, you know, Carolyn Jones playing Morticia, which is not related to this at all. Right. But you basically ask about how to shoot this thing, without flash, because you might be in the audience or whatever, and you want to photograph the rehearsals, the dress rehearsal for your ballet performances or your wife's ballet performances. Available light and stage photography is always a difficult thing. But it need not be as difficult as it appears. The basics are, a few fundamental principles, and if you can work with these, you'll be successful. You talk about the fact that you have, sort of a medium range zoom, which opens from 3.5 to 4.5, and I'm presuming that you will shoot at the longer end of that, meaning that your lens is, f4.5 in, an available light stage performance style situation. F4.5 is going to make your life very difficult. You say in your email that you shoot at 800 or 1600 ISO, which will increase your noise, and that's a bit of a sad thing. We're used to noise, I suppose, in available light performance photography, but it need not necessarily be the case. I would suggest, and if you're going to be doing this regularly, that you invest in a fast lens. That would be your first step. The best combination of lens and aperture, lens in terms of focal length, aperture in terms of, something fast, and proximity to the performance is the combination you really have to work with. Lens, aperture, or focal length, aperture, and proximity. I do, a fair bit of stage photography, and there are two lenses I rely on all the time, and that is my 85mm 1.8, which I mention, I think, almost every podcast. Or my 50mm 1.8. I don't have a 51.4, I have a 51.8, which on my D200, magnifies out to about the equivalent of
75.
About 75. Or my 80-200 2.8, which now is fabulous because it's the equivalent of a 300 in old terms of 2.8. And I'm quite capable of shooting, at 100 or 200 ISO with those lenses and getting, 125th of a second, 250th of a second in stage photography. And the reason that that's possible is because, one, I open the lens right up. So on the 85, I've got 1.8. On the 80-200, or 2.8. The 85, and I've got 2.8. So technically just a little over a stop difference. The 50mm, of course, is 1.8 also. So I've got a fast enough shutter speed. I don't need depth of field really, because I'm probably going to concentrate on one performer at a time. That is my only option as such, but, if I can stop down, but I mean, in order to get depth of field, you're going to have to stop down too much to sort of make the thing work. So I would suggest your first place to go, Sean, is if this is something you're going to do regularly, then buy a lens to suit. Get an 80-200 2.8, get an 85 1.8 or equivalent, or something like that, a 100mm 2.8, a 135 2.8. Any of those would be fine, but you're going to have to use something faster than 4.5.
First stop should be eBay.
eBay, yeah. Have a look and see what's available.
There's some
by
good
all
stuff
means.
Out there.
Is there?
Yeah.
I haven't done the eBay thing yet. Would you believe it? But I'm after a 135 2.8 lens for Nikon. So if anybody sees a good deal on that, let me know. That might be my new live-in lens. Then, of course, the other thing to think about, Sean, is metering. And you talk a little bit about that in your email because you seem to be thrown by it a little bit. In a situation of performance photography, meter, usually a stage is pretty well lit. It's like photographing the moon. People think, it's going to take me hours to photograph the moon. But no, the moon is a sunlit object. You can, like a human being is a sunlit object. Just because it's surrounded by dark black sky at night doesn't mean that your shutter speed needs to be very long. So it's the same with stage photography. The performers are quite heavily lit, and it's only the background that often is dark. If you meter for the fact that they are lit by a frontal, spotlight or something like that, you actually should get, a fairly decent shutter speed, especially if you are shooting at 85, at 1.8 rather, or 2.8 or something like that. Like I say, I've been able to shoot at 100, 200 ISO, 400 at the most with these lenses, and still get 125th, 250th of a second without a problem. only because I haven't necessarily gone to the camera's meter. I've what I call gut metered. And shooting digitally means you can without risking anything. So there I am, and I will upload a few performance photographs for you to look at to audiotu.com. You can see what I've done. I'm in the situation. I'm photographing the performers. They're lit by all the colored lights and the spotlights, etc., etc. And I've sort of gut metered the thing at 2.8 at 200th or 250th of a second, taken the shot, checked the screen, checked my histogram, seeing that, you know, I haven't blown anything out, etc., etc., and said, right, well, that's my setting. And if the lighting remains very much the same, I can shoot at this, you know, for the whole song or the whole performance, depending on how, you know, the variations in lighting will go. Often what your camera will do is see a whole bunch of black, and this still happens, of course, even with the most modern metering techniques or the most modern metering technologies. They will see a whole lot of black and say, gee, it's dark in here, better open up. Hmm. But your subject is very heavily lit by the spotlights and the backlighting, etc. So you really should have enough lighting there to just concentrate on the subject. And like the old song says, black is black. So, you know, you would technically not be underexposing, but your camera thinks you're underexposing. Set your camera manually.
Yep.
Set a shutter speed you want to work at, and off you go. And see how you go with it. But, you know, you shouldn't have to go to 800 or 1600 ISO if you've got a fast lens and, you know, you're working with that. Again, the other thing comes up, though, is proximity. If you're sitting way back in row P or Q or S or T and you're trying to photograph, you're going to have to be at the wrong end of your zoom. And with a variable aperture zoom like the one you're working with, you're going to be at the wrong end of your widest aperture, which will be, you know, like you say, 4.5. Why not try and get in a little bit closer? Even with an 80-odd mil, and if you're sitting way back in the audience, you're not going to get great photographs. If it's the dress rehearsal, then you should be able to, you know, come up nice and close, really, to the stage. And my suggestion would be that you make a deal with the company. You will be their official photographer. You will supply them all their photographs, and that gives you special rights as a photographer, either on the dress rehearsal to maybe even access the stage during, you know, or side stage, or right up the front of the stage, or in front of the stage. And if you wanted to push it, you know, see if they want to buy your images, and you can buy that 85mm 1.8 that you want to shoot with. But see if you can make a deal with them to supply them official images. They're going to need photographs, aren't they, to promote the performance or next year's performance or for the company itself. Give that a try. But try becoming their official photographer, and you will have greater rights of proximity than anybody else.
Probably one other thing. Sorry.
Yeah, no, go right ahead.
I was going to say probably one other thing that I would throw in, and you may have been going to get to this, Shelton, and I think I've said this before. Shoot raw if you can, and if you need to shoot a stop under it, because you don't have a fast enough lens, then with the raw data, you should be able to reclaim that image. You know, even if you shot at a stop under.
Yeah, yeah. Sean mentions that he shoots in RAW, and thank you for reminding
me. Oh, did he?
Okay. No, that's fine.
I haven't seen the email, so.
No, I'm glad you mentioned it, because it's true. He shoots in RAW, and that's a good thing. If you can shoot in RAW and JPEG simultaneously, like my wonderful D200 can, then I'd suggest you do that. But, shooting in RAW is great, and you can reclaim the data. It will slightly increase your noise, but it's sort of, you might get a faster, you know, you might not have to do that. So that certainly is a great idea. And the... you also talk about color balance, Sean. Well, stage lighting is one of those things. You will have red lights and green lights and blue lights, and so you will, you know, the camera will sort of give you those funny color casts, but that's the nature of performance photography. There's a red light on your subject, the subject's going to be red. I'd have to see
Would you recommend, Shelton, in an instance like that, of actually setting a manual white balance before you start shooting?
Yes, look, I think there'd be a few things you could do, and this would vary from photographer to photographer, but you could set for tungsten, which is what they use in stage performance, and whatever color light happens. You could set a manual white balance, which is a bit of trial and error, but that... might work, or you can go to auto and let the camera decide for each and every photograph. That will be less consistent than using, you know, say, a fixed white balance setting.
But my fear was that if you had it on auto, that the camera would be constantly trying to compensate for the colour of the lighting on stage.
Yes.
Where if you had sort of set yourself an arbitrary, you know, white balance to begin with in manual white balance mode,
it would be consistent.
At least, yeah.
Yes, yes. You'd have to make sure that as you set that white balance that, you know, you're from, at least from the screen, you could see that your white was pretty good and you know, not any particular shade of any other color. Once you've got that established, no matter what happens, you know, red lights, blue lights, green lights, if you know, you should be pretty, you know, consistent with your white balance. The thing about performance photography, though, is that, you know, you do expect a certain amount of color cast. People are used to going to concerts and seeing U2 lit up green, and, you know, the Rolling Stones lit up, well, blue or whatever. They're used to seeing that, so it's not a problem from the perspective of the viewer, because if they weren't there, then they don't know what color the lighting was anyway. But it's not something that is unusual to the viewer to see a performance with certain colored lights. So, you know, don't worry too much about that, unless, of course, it's really freaking you out and it's just wrong, in which case I would suggest, as you did, Bruce, that you set, you know, a manual white balance, either by going to straight to the tungsten setting or setting it manually as per a number that you could use consistently. But those are the tried and true techniques that, you know, photographers who've been shooting performances for years have always done. It's fast lenses, proximity to the stage, and metering correctly. Metering, I suppose you could say, for the highlights. Metering for the subject that is in the way that they are lit. And I will upload some photographs to audiotu.com that I've done in performances that have not presented any problem at all in terms of shutter speed, in terms of, you know, aperture and blur or anything like that. So hopefully, Sean, that helps. I would really love to get your feedback, Sean, and of course any of the feedback from our listeners on how they've coped in similar situations, and whether they have any further questions on this subject, because it is one that will, you know, arise in the life of every photographer sooner or later, and is, you know, not that difficult to fix, really.
I've got some live concert photography that I've done, but it was all done in film day, so I couldn't tell you what shutter speeds and ISOs I used.
Right. How did you go with it?
Very happy. I've had some great results.
Yeah.
I shot Hot House Flowers and Dire Straits in Hobart back in the 90s when Dire Straits had just released the On Every Street album.
Yep.
So it was that tour.
Mm-hmm.
I shot an Australian band called The Angels.
Yes.
At a New Year's Eve gig in Northern Tasmania back in the 90s as well. That they came out really well.
Mm-hmm.
And there is one particular photo of I only got a handful of shots off in this particular concert, but this one photo I'm absolutely stoked with. In Excess, Full Moon Dirty Hearts tour.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this was, mid to late 90s, so about 96, maybe a bit earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
Playing at the Theatre Royal, or the Royal Theatre in Canberra, which is a really small room. It's only about a 1,500-seat room.
What?
Yep.
Boy.
And I smuggled my what did I have at the time? My 7000i, Konica 7000i. Minolta 7000i. And I got this shot of Michael Hutchence with his hand, like he's holding the mic in his left hand, and with his right hand, he's holding onto the hand of a person in the crowd.
Cool.
And
that person wants that photo.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Mm.
And it's a photo that I've never ever released to anybody. No one's ever seen it. So I might just put up a low res copy of it.
Yeah.
Because I'm very proud of that shot.
Well, considering he died the year later.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You know, it'll be 10 years this November.
Yeah, I remember exactly where I was. I was on a boat in the middle of
Lake... Let me guess, it was a catamaran on the harbour with models. And
quite the opposite. It was a rowboat on Lake Nasser. Lake Nasser in southern Egypt.
Wow.
In the middle of nowhere, and it was my wedding anniversary.
Wow.
And my wife was here in Australia, and I was leading a photo tour through Egypt. And my guide had a mobile phone, and he suddenly got reception. So I rang Australia from his mobile phone.
Yeah.
And or did my wife ring me? I can't remember. But anyway, there I was in the middle of nowhere, and talking to my wife, happy anniversary, you know, la la la, all these miles apart.
Yeah.
And she said Michael Hutchence had died. So I remember exactly, you know, there's one of those moments where you know exactly where you were. And of course, being in the middle of a lake in Egypt on your wedding anniversary, you are going to sort of remember. But yeah, it's 10 years. Can you believe that? 10 years. So that photograph, probably worth, you know, well, to that person.
Yeah.
Find that person.
Yeah.
And
I'd love to know about it.
But that we'll post up a few photographs so you can see that the techniques we've talked about, the lenses, the apertures, the shutter speeds, the proximities, all work and, you know, can make the whole thing quite easy, really. So I hope that helps you, Sean. Let me know if it doesn't. Let me know if my principles have not applied to your situation, and then we'll have to readdress it.
Fantastic. All right, Shelton, thank you for that.
That's again my pleasure.
Excellent.
No worries. I'll talk about photography forever, which, as anybody can tell from this podcast, is quite possible.
All right, mate. We'll talk with you next week.
You bet. See you soon.
See you later.
Bye.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.